listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Я бы не хотел говорить про коммунизм.
I don't want to talk about communism here.
That was the late president of the Russian Federation, Boris Yeltsin. 29 years ago this month, in September of 1989, he was a member then of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, speaking at Johns Hopkins University on the future of Soviet democracy.
Какого числа и какого месяца и года он наступит в СССР?
I don't want to try to tell you what year or what day and what time of the day communism will finally be realized in the USSR.
Имею в виду, что это просто идея заоблачная, о которой можно мечтать, рассуждать, но не реализовать.
Bearing in mind, as we now know, that communism is really just an idea, sort of pie in the sky, which we should think about and keep our eyes on, but we shouldn't try to implement it here on Earth.
Again, that was the late Russian President Boris Yeltsin, September of 1990 at Johns Hopkins University here in the United States, discussing the future of Soviet democracy. In May of the following year, Yeltsin would become the president of the Supreme Soviet and begin a process that led by December of 1991 to the dissolution of the USSR, thereby terminating any opportunity to democratize it. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Luciana Bone. We heard from Boris Yeltsin. He offered his view of communism as being something pie in the sky. Let's not actually try to use that as policy. That's basically what he was saying. This is, 72 years after the October Revolution.
Right. Yep. during which, we never forget, Russia was industrialized in 10 years between 1930 and 1940.
Yeah, twice, actually, because after being devastated in World War II, they industrialized again, like 1945 to 1950.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I have plenty of little drastic statistics of what happened when Mr. Yeltsin actually got his hands on the state, the Russian
right.
state,
yeah.
In 1991. So just one thing to say to begin with. I want to answer him and say that in the transition from a collectivized to a privatized economy, that's essentially what he did, between 1991 and 1994, the Russian population lost nearly 5 years of life expectancy. That's just a little
right.
detail. So, but I think that the, you know, Putin said that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was one of the greatest catastrophes of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And indeed it was. And I want to say that the Soviet Union made in the 1990s a tragic mistake, one that China, Vietnam, Laos, for example, did not make. So in China, Vietnam, Laos, the leadership effected economic market reforms, sort of, what is it, market socialism is called?
Yeah, right.
They did effect these reforms in the 80s and 90s, but they didn't change the political structure and the ideological character of the state. Their constitution kept the Marxist-Leninist ideology and instituted a program of the road to socialism and eventual communism, and kept intact the Communist Party as the leadership, as having the leader, you know, as the leadership of the state. Now, in the Soviet Union, what happened was that the political structures that had been the Soviet Union were dismantled. That means they killed all that the Bolshevik Revolution had built. And in fact, we heard Yeltsin saying, let's not talk about communism. Communism was just an idea, just a pie in the sky. So they killed the Communist Party, the Politburo, the Supreme Soviet, the Economic State Planning Institution, and replaced all by Western-style parliamentary democracy with a so-called multi-party structure, which is, of course,
It's a bourgeois party with many faces.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a bourgeois party with multiple marketing faces replacing the Workers' Party.
Yeah. Eventually, we do right. have the Russian Communist Party, which is a reformed party. But anyway, this Western-style parliamentary democracy imposed a rapid and radical change from the collectivized economy, from the socialized economy, socialist economy, to market economy. And it adapted shock therapy. It's important to see how this political, how the destruction of the political system occurred in 1991 under Yeltsin's rule, you know, direction. And so in the year 1991 saw the abolition of the Communist Party, the introduction of a market economy, and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And just to recap what we said very briefly, just the crucial months of 1991, in August 24th, Yeltsin transferred the archives of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to the authorities of the state archives of the state of Russia. On August 24th, Mikhail Gorbachev created that Committee for the Operational Administration of the Soviet Economy. This is all before the dissolution in December. Right. On August 25th, Yeltsin nationalized the properties of the Communist Party's Soviet Union in Russia, including not only party offices, but also educational institutions, hotels, everything. And on November 30th, Yeltsin ended the activity of the Communist Party Soviet Union in Russia. And then on November 1st began the radical economic reforms. You see where I'm getting there, that they are in order to actually implement this radical reform, they had to dismantle the whole state architecture. Now we come to the last act, which is 8 December 1991, and we talk about the Belavezha Accord, which was effected the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And it said, this Belavezha Accord said, the USSR, as a subject of international law and a geopolitical reality, is ceasing its existence. Very, very thought about phrases. Subject of international law, it's not longer, and geopolitical reality is out. Now, what is terrible about this is that the presidents of Russia, Ukraine, and Belarusia were the only three who signed this dissolution of the Soviet Union. Boris Yeltsin, Leonid Kravchuk, and Stanislav Shushkevich met in the nature reserve of Belaveshkaya Pushka. They declared the dissolution of the Soviet Union. They established a sort of interim name for it, the Commonwealth of Independent States. The agreement was made despite the fact, as we always mention, that in March of that year, the population voted 78% overall to keep and conserve the Soviet Union. Now, the signing of the treaty was communicated by telephone first to President Bush in the United States by Yeltsin, and second by Shushkevich to Mikhail Gorbachev.
Right. They told Bush before they told Gorbachev.
Yeah, yeah. And you could see this is three republics of the Soviet Union signed an agreement to dissolve it. There's absolutely no legality in this. There's no consultation with the people.
Right.
And this is how it was done.
Yeah, actually it was done in opposition to a consultation, to the outcome of a consultation with the people. The people had their say in March. The people overwhelmingly said, keep the Soviet Union, and these, you know, Molary and Shampovich show up in a room somewhere and decide to change the situation to their liking anyway. And you left just one thing out I wanted to mention in the list of things that you listed, which we hit last time, was after August, the so-called coup attempt, in September, one of the first things that they did was to privatize the Ministry of Fuel and Energy into Rosneftgaz. In other words, the oil and gas reserves of the people of the Soviet Union that were being administered by the Ministry of Fuel and Energy were privatized. This is months before the Soviet Union was dissolved. It was by the Soviet government under Gorbachev.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember. Yes. That's right. And later they kept price control on that, unlike any other aspect of the economy. When, you know. Well, so we talk about the, we come to talk about the actual shock therapy here.
Jeffrey Sachs.
Sorry, what?
Jeffrey Sachs.
Jeffrey Sachs. Larry Summers,
Igor Gaidar, Anatoly Chubais, the whole group.
Yeah. Well, so, but already, excuse me about the voice, but already in, so the reform started in November, that is, actually in October 1991, 2 months before the official dissolution of the Soviet Union, Yeltsin and his advisors, including the reform economist, neoliberal
right.
economist Yegor Gaidar, who became Yeltsin's, I think, economic minister or something in the ministry. He was sacked in 1994, but and is now somewhere within the American sphere of think tanks, etc.
We're tending bar
anyway,
somewhere.
Sorry, what?
We're tending bar somewhere. I'm sure you had plenty of experience with Yeltsin doing that.
So they, in October, established a program of radical economic reforms through shock therapy. And but in reality, you know, I mean, it was a confederation of bureaucrats, gangsters, politicians,
right.
and they just seized and privatized the most profitable wings
right.
of the Soviet Union's economy. And as you pointed out, the first thing they did,
right, grab the
got
oil,
their hands on the oil on the energy industry,
that's right.
which
yep.
Putin has been collecting back.
That's right. That's his big. That's Putin's big sin. Is that
yeah.
the people that look? So here you go. You have somewhere in a back room, somewhere in a cave, God knows where. Maybe it's next to Bin Laden's cave. All the characters that really run the world, that own everything, have their
yeah.
annual or weekly or whatever meeting, and they all sit around. So who are you? I'm Bill Gates. I own this software thing, and I'm so and so. I own Apple. And who are you? I own Russian oil and gas supplies. That's the richest guy in the room, okay?
Yes,
and all of a sudden,
right.
that was the wealth of the Soviet peoples, and suddenly it belonged to a couple of guys who were allowed to do what they want with it. And Yeltsin's
yep.
Putin's big sin was to pull them back in and say, uh-uh. Maybe you'll be allowed to continue to own this and make some money on it, but the goals of this enterprise are subordinated to the Russian national interest. This is a national
right.
security issue, and this wealth of the Russian people will be used to help build Russia. And that is his big offense in the eyes of the world.
Yeah, yeah. And in effect, if you look at what Putin did, is another reconstruction of the psychology and part of the economy of the Soviet Union after this devastation
right.
of shock therapy and
they looted
Russia the way they treated Greece.
Right.
There are different mechanisms, but it's the same thing. Go ahead.
They looted it. That's what they do. It's, you know,
what is
it? There's like the Mel Brooks movies have like Engulf and Devour Corporation. You know, that's what they do. You have two models in the world. The U.S. goes in and they basically bring guns, point them at everybody, say, go get your stuff and bring it to my boat. No, I'm not building you a road. Go get your stuff and bring it to my boat or we'll kill you and your family. Well, let's kill your family first just to give you some motivation. That's the U.S. model. China has a different model. Hey, you know what? We want some of your stuff. Let's build you a factory. You can sell some cars. You can just give us some of the stuff. We'll give you gas or whatever and blah, blah, blah. Win-win. Those are the two models. The model, the short language version for the Western model, which is imperialism, that's really the economic and political condition we're talking about, is looting. That's what they do. They loot.
Yep, that's exactly right. And so, shock therapy, of course, was first tried in Chile. And it's an economic term, and it refers to the sudden release of price and currency controls, withdrawal of state subsidies, and immediate trade liberalization within a country, including large-scale privatization of previously public-owned assets. So what did Yeltsin do? What did this amount? Well, large state-owned industries were put up for sale at throwaway prices. And this was called the largest garage sale in history.
Right.
Collective farms were removed with no food leaving no food security. Foreign trade was liberalized significantly, radically. And the list of Russia's trading partners became dominated by Western European rather than East European and former Soviet countries. The old system of social welfare was destroyed, and the government stopped all subsidies. Overnight, pensioners lost money that was expected to see them through their old age. Professors and military officers, people who would have had good lives in the Soviet system, you know, now earn pitifully small salaries.
Right.
And particularly hard hit were people who went to work in Siberia, the Far East, the Russian Arctic, and they went there for triple wages and suddenly found themselves with no savings and not enough food to feed themselves and their families. There were even reports of unpaid workers collapsing in the streets from hunger and people freezing to death because they couldn't afford to heat their homes.
Right.
The middle section of the society suffered, of course, professors, teachers, etc. But those who were educated either migrated to different countries or simply fell apart, disintegrated. The new mafia emerged. Of course, Yeltsin's family mafia was one of them. And, you know, just like in fascist situation in Latin America, backed by economic, they enforced economic activities by force. You know, privatization widened, of course, the gap between rich and poor. So when in January 1992, the government ended price controls, the result was 2,520% inflation in 1992, the first year of economic reform. Ordinary Russians saw their savings vaporized, their salaries crash, and the cost of ordinary items like eggs and chickens cost a month's salary. So when state controls were lifted, the prices for basic foods like bread and butter shot up as much as 500% in a matter of days. The inflation rate was higher than 100% a month. It was 245% in 1992. This was a social devastation.
The privatization.
Go ahead.
When they were essentially, I mean, you were talking about gangster capitalism, basically. From the time of the creation of the Soviet Union, the Soviet economy was locked out of the West and the parts of Asia that were controlled by the West, which have up until the late 40s was most of Asia, and still remains a substantial part of Asia, Among the other problems that is presented for Soviet economy, the currency was rejected by the West. They wouldn't take Soviet currency, rubles, for Western goods. So they had to do all kinds of barter arrangements and things when they finally started to engage. And what that meant,
Cuba.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and what that meant on the ground in the USSR was as these some of these businesses were privatized and shut down, and so now you had to import food, for example, the currency that the average working person had to work with was basically worthless, and so they and the banking system that grew up within the Soviet sphere was completely rejected, and it was eliminated in favor of, in essence, I mean, there were official structures that remained and ended up being converted. But what you had happen was gangster capitalism in the form of black marketeers and money launderers acquiring capital and ending up being the junior partners of Western capital, setting up a financial sector in Russia. And so the whole purchasing power and the banking and the exchange and all of the things that deal with finance in Russia were built on the back of a mafia, essentially, or a mafia construct, and that was easily controlled by a small group of people inside Russia, and really was developed to be subservient to Western finance capital.
Right. There were no structures in place that could sustain a market economy, that could go directly from it, and this facilitated the gangster. There were no legal institutions, no.
Right.
There was no architecture that could sustain all of a sudden a market economy of the kind.
Right.
So it was just plain looting. So the shock therapy strategy was devised by Harvard economist Jeffrey Sachs.
Right.
And it was supported by Larry Summers, the U.S. Undersecretary of the Treasury in charge of international affairs. Sachs had already developed an economic strategy for Poland and then was asked to do the same thing for Russia. So what Sachs and Summers did was encourage the United States to push the IMF and the World Bank to lend Russia tens of billions of dollars to prop up the ruble.
Right.
So where before it wasn't even, in the geography, financial geography of the West. So now prop it up so it could be internationally convertible and attract investment and, in their view, kickstart the economy. I hate that word. Their economy, it's nothing to do. So, of course, the Russia, these economic reformers were branded as good guys by the United States, the West in general. And as we mentioned, Gaidar was the architect of Yeltsin's original economic plan way back in October. And then just these international lenders, just hear the title they have, the international lenders such as the International Monetary Fund, well, we're familiar with that, but the Paris Club of Western Government Lenders. Who are they? And the London Club of International Commercial Banks. These are people who gather in rooms.
Right.
And they plot. They provided substantial aid, and with the proviso that Russia must improve economic indicators, and such as its inflation rate and budget deficits. In other words, the same thing that is done to Burkina Faso, that is required Venezuela to do. That's what a regime change in Venezuela would do.
Right.
It was done in Russia, and these idiots expected this great old country that has gone through all kinds of massive tragedies and historical trauma, they expected it to become Burkina Faso.
Right, that's right. That was the goal. You know, there's a contemporary example of that right now in South America, several, but one is most glaring, Argentina, where, 20 years ago, you had a complete and total economic catastrophe there.
In 2000, yes.
Okay, and then Nestor Kirchner, a couple of terms of him and a term and a half, I think, of his wife, they turned the country around completely, using leftist, liberal economics, at least, not neoliberal, but actual, Keynesian economics and some social some socialist planning. And Macri gets elected in December of 2015, and, less than 3 years later, they have brought Argentina right back to the same place, where the IMF is now.
I understand now there is a complete general strike in Argentina. That's You're up to date with that, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's you know, basically what they did was impose the same neoliberal program on the Argentinian economy almost immediately after he got elected in December of 2015. And
immediately.
It took less than 3 years like to devastate the economy.
Yeah, and a flight of capital.
Yep.
And the 2000 was tragic because I was in Italy in 2000 in December when Argentina went belly up and the people were in the street screaming, yeah, basta. You know, that was just go, everybody get out.
Right.
They threw everybody out, defaulted on the debt. And, of course, Argentina and Italy are highly connected. I mean, it's just like a... Because so many Italians, if you look at the names,
for sure,
so many Argentinians are from Italy.
Yes.
So there was a great deal of sympathy, and so I remember it very well. But now to see it go back is just amazing. They keep coming back. They never give up.
I know it.
So, well, of course, to return to the economic. What I call the economic genocide or the tsunami of shock therapy.
Yeah.
In the course of Yeltsin's era, per capita income fell by about 75%, and the nation's population fell by more than 2 million, due largely to the steep decline in public health, what Stalin had built.
That's right. And by the way, that's on a base in, this is now the Russian Republic, that's on a base of about 150 million people. So you're talking, you know, about 1.35% roughly or something, 1 1/3% of the whole population.
Yeah, but it's more, this estimate was then revised in 2009 by the Lancet. I'll get to that, I hope.
All I'm saying is one in 100 people died. One in 100, more than that, like 1.5 in 100 died. And so
the state industry, of course, collapsed because, and this has happened all over the Balkans as well, all over Eastern Europe.
Look at Ukraine.
Many people lost their jobs, were not paid.
Yep, look at Ukraine. Ukraine is still suffering from this now. Luciana, thank you very much, and we'll pick it up here next week.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. U.S. President Donald Trump was in New York on Wednesday at the United Nations General Assembly. In the late afternoon, he took time out to hold a press conference, which we bring you in its entirety.
We've had a great 3 days at the United Nations in New York, and this is quite a gathering. Wow. It's a lot of people. A lot of media. We've covered a great deal of territory. Just left, as you know, Prime Minister Abe of Japan. We're starting trade talks with Japan. They were not willing for years to talk trade, and now they're willing to talk trade. And I'm sure we'll make a very good deal. Just concluded, as you know, 2 days ago, signed a deal with South Korea, trade deal, tremendous deal with South Korea. It means a lot of business for our farmers. We're opening up for farmers. We're opening up for a lot of different groups. We're going to be able to sell much more than double the number of automobiles that we were allowed under a deal that was totally defective that was there before. And so we're very happy with that. That deal is actually concluded. We're very well along the way with Mexico. The relationship is very good. And with Canada, we'll see what happens. They're charging us 300% tariffs on dairy products. We can't have that. We can't have that. With China, as you know, we put out an announcement today. They would like to see me lose an election because they've never been challenged like this. But I want to open up China to our farmers and to our industrialists and our companies. And China is not open, but we're open to them. They charge us 25, 35, 55% for things, and we charge them nothing in terms of coming into the country. Cars, they're at 25%, and we're at 2% and 2.5%, and don't even collect it, but we collect it now. So we're doing very well in our situation with China on trade. I have a great relationship with the president of China, President Xi. But it's got to be a two-way street. It, for 25 years and longer, was not. And trillions of dollars was taken out of the United States for the benefit of China. We just can't have that. We have to make it fair. So we're at $250 billion now at 25% interest, and a lot of money is coming into our coffers. And it's had no impact on our — absolutely, by the way, no impact on our economy, which I said it wouldn't. In fact, steel is like the hottest industry there is. If you look at what happened with steel, we're charging a 25% tariff for the dumpers. They dump massive amounts of steel. They want to put the steel companies out of business. And after they're out of business, they'll come in and charge five times more than you ever thought possible. And we need steel and we need aluminum. And those industries are doing well, but steel is incredible. U.S. Steel is opening up a minimum of 8 plants. Nucor is opening up plants, and these are big plants, $750 million and $1 billion plants in some cases. So what's happening with the steel industry is very exciting to me. It's being rebuilt overnight. If you look at the miners and coal, if you look at energy, LNG, Japan just gave us some numbers that are incredible. They're doubling the amount that they are going to be buying for Japan. They're taking the LNG and they're doubling it up. I said, you have to do me a favor. We don't want these big deficits. You're going to have to buy more. They're buying massive amounts of equipment and military equipment. And other countries are doing the same thing because we have trade imbalances with almost everybody. It's a rare exception that we don't. So we are doing great as a country. Unfortunately, they just raised interest rates a little bit because we are doing so well. I'm not happy about that because I know it's going to be a question. I am not happy about that. I'd rather pay down debt or do other things, create more jobs. So I'm worried about the fact that they seem to like raising interest rates. We can do other things with the money. And but they raised them. And they're raising them because we're doing so well. You know, we're doing much better than I had projected in terms of when I was campaigning. I said we were going to do this, and we're doing much better than anybody ever thought possible. And I will say, if others got in, it would have been just the opposite, because they were going to put restrictions on, they were going to put regulations on, they were going to choke the economy as it was already choking, but it would have been worse, and they were going to raise your taxes. That's what they want to do now if they ever got control, which I don't think they'll have control for a long time. So with that being said, we'll take some questions, and yes, please. John, go ahead. We have plenty of time.
Mr. President, thank you very much. Of course, what you're looking forward to tomorrow is the hearings with Judge Kavanaugh before the Judiciary Committee.
Yes.
In 1991, when Joe Biden passed along to the Bush 41 White House the allegations that Anita Hill had raised against Clarence Thomas, the Bush White House asked the FBI to look into it as part of Judge Thomas's background investigation. Not a criminal investigation, but the background investigation.
Right.
When these allegations were raised, why didn't this White House do the same thing? And with all of the allegations that are coming out now about Judge Kavanaugh, was there an opportunity missed here to have investigators look into this and get some sort of clarity one way or the other?
Well, the FBI told us they've investigated Judge Kavanaugh 6 times, 5 times, many times over the years. They know him very well. But here there was nothing to investigate from at least one standpoint. They didn't know the location. They didn't know the time. They didn't know the year. They didn't know anything. And it's like, where do you go? Also, it's not for the FBI. If you look at what Joe Biden said, he said, they don't do this. And he said it very clearly. So I think when you really look at it all, it's not going to change any of the Democrats' minds. They're obstructionists. They're actually con artists because they know how quality this man is, and they've destroyed a man's reputation. And they want to destroy it even more. And I think people are going to see that in the midterms, what they've done to this family, what they've done to these children, these beautiful children of his, and what they've done to his wife. And they know it's a big, fat con job. and they go into a room, and I guarantee you, they laugh like hell at what they pulled off on you and on the public. They laugh like hell. So it wouldn't have mattered if the FBI came back with the cleanest score, and you understand that very well, John. If they would have come back with the most perfect, we found everything, and he's perfectly innocent of everything, it wouldn't have made a difference. You wouldn't have gotten one vote. Now, we will get votes from the Democrats if we win. You'll have 3, 4, or 5 Democrats giving us votes because they're in states that I won by 30 and 40 points, and they're going to give us votes. But other than that, you probably won't get any, John. Yes, go ahead, please.
Mr. President, there are now 3 women accusing Judge Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct. Are you saying that all 3 of those women are liars? Is there anything that could be said at this meeting tomorrow that could cause you to withdraw the nomination? Anything at all that...
I won't get into that game. I only tell you this. This is one of the highest quality people that I've ever met. And everybody that knows him says the same thing. And these are all false to me. These are false accusations in certain cases, and certain cases, even the media agrees with that. I can only say that what they've done to this man is incredible. You know, it's very interesting. I pick a lot of judges. I have 145 judges I will be picking by the end of a fairly short period of time because President Obama wasn't big on picking judges. When I got there, I said, how is this possible? I have 145, including Court of Appeals judges. And they just didn't do it. You know why? They got tired. They got complacent. Something happened. I have 145 judges. Everybody wants to be a federal judge, not just a Supreme Court judge. I'm talking about Court of Appeals. I'm talking about district court. I don't think they're going to want to so much. I'll be calling people, and we'll have people calling people that do this. And people are going to be scared because we could say it about you. 35 years ago, you met, and you might not know what's going on. What is going on? Why did they wait so long? Why did Senator Feinstein wait till the hearings were over and make this case? Why didn't she bring it right at the beginning when you ask about, as an example, the FBI? Why didn't they bring this right at the beginning during the hearing? You would have had all the time in the world for the FBI. It would have been fine. Now, the FBI, as you know, did investigate this time, as they have 5 or 6 other times, and they did a very thorough investigation. But this is a big con job, and I would love to be in the room with the Democrats, close the door. You guys are all away outside waiting, and Schumer and his buddies are all in there laughing how they fooled you all. Let's just stop them. A big, fat con. Yeah,
but,
go ahead.
But, Mr. President, if I could follow up, you have daughters. Can you understand why a victim of sexual assault would not report it at the time? Don't you understand?
By the way, I only say this. 36 years, no charge, no nothing.
But that happens often. I mean,
people are going to have to make a decision. 36 years, there's no charge. All of a sudden, the hearings are over. And the rumors start coming out. And then you have this other con artist, Avenatti, come out with another beauty today. I only say that you have to look at the facts. The senators are very capable people. They're very good people. I know many of them. They're friends of mine. These are very talented, very good people. And they're going to vote. They're going to have to believe what they believe. When I look at what's happened to the reputation of a great gentleman, a great intellect, a brilliant man, somebody that has a chance to be one of our great Supreme Court justices in history, intellectually, I think it's a shame. Yes, please.
Yes, Mr. President, my name is Tomas Regalado from Radio and TV Martí. Mr. President, yesterday at the speech at the UN, you spoke about how Venezuela's problem was because of Cuba and the Castros, how they went in there and they brought socialism and communism to Venezuela and now to Nicaragua as well. Mr. President, are you going to be more proactive now against Cuba as well?
I've been very proactive against Cuba. I don't like what's happening in Cuba. As you know, President Obama gave them a pass, and I didn't like it. Neither do Cuban people based in Miami and based in our country that came from Cuba and suffered in Cuba. I don't like what he did. I've ended much of it, most of it. I don't like what's happening in Cuba, and I certainly don't like what's happening in Venezuela. Yes,
Mr.
please.
President.
Go ahead.
Mr. President, just to finish really fast, you said also that you had a call to action to ask the leaders around the world to also end socialism. Would you like to be recognized as a...
Well, president? I wouldn't say that socialism has been working really well around the world. Okay, you can take a look at Venezuela as your number one. Your number one, I guess the one that's most obvious, but you take a look around the world, socialism is not exactly riding high. Please.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. If you don't mind, after I'm finished, if Ouija or Hallie or Vivian or one of our female colleagues could go after me, that would be great. Mr. President, just to follow up on these allegations against Brett Kavanaugh.
What does he mean by that? Explain. What does that mean?
I think it would be great if a female...
What does it mean?
I think it would be great if a female reporter would ask you a question about this issue. So if you don't mind...
I wouldn't mind that at all.
All right. Well, let me...
Wouldn't make any difference to me.
All right.
Go ahead.
If I could follow up on John and John's question, why is it, Mr. President, that you always seem to side with the accused and not the accuser? You have three women here who are all making allegations, who are all asking that their stories be heard. And, you know, if you look at the case of Roy Moore, if you look at the case of one of your staffers, you seem to time and again side with the accused and not the accuser. Is that because of the many allegations that you've had made against you over the years?
Well, first of all, I wasn't happy with Roy Moore. Let's get that straight. But Roy Moore was a Republican candidate, and I would have rather had a Republican candidate win. I was very happy with Luther Strange, who was a terrific man from Alabama, but Luther Strange had a lot of things going against him. As far as women, whether it's a man or a woman, these are, you know, it can happen the other way. Allegations can go the other way also. You understand that. And whether it was a man or a woman 30 years ago, 36 years ago, in fact, they don't even know how many years ago because nobody knows what the time is. That's a long time. And I could pick, as an example, hopefully I won't have to do it as a replacement, because hopefully this is going to go very well on Thursday. It's going to go very well on Monday or Saturday or Sunday or whenever they vote. But I could pick a woman, and she could have charges made from many years ago also.
But don't you
understand? And I would look at the character. No, what I have to do.
Are reluctant to come forward. You've raised doubts about these accusers. Many of them.
I don't think people are reluctant to come forward. They're going to have a chance to speak at a they have a major chance to speak. Excuse me. They have a major chance to speak. And it will be tomorrow, I assume. We've delayed this, meaning the Republican senators, not me. The Republican senators have delayed this for weeks now. They're giving the women a major chance to speak. Now, it's possible I'll hear that and I'll say, hey, I'm changing my mind. That is possible. We want to give them a chance to speak.
Do you think all three
and they're given.
All three should have the chance?
Well, whoever is given a chance, we've delayed it a long time, but they're going to have a big shot at speaking and making their case. And you know what? I could be persuaded also. Okay? Yes, please. Please, go ahead. Go ahead. I'd like to go. Yes, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. And a couple of questions for you to follow up on some answers that I didn't quite hear from you, if you would allow me a couple of questions. First of all, do you think these women, all three of them, are liars? Yes or no?
Have they been what?
Are they liars?
I can't tell you. I have to watch tomorrow. I have to read. I just heard about one a little while ago. I can tell you her lawyer is a lowlife, okay? So I can't tell you whether or not they're liars until I hear them. I don't know what happened today because I've been very busy with Japan, with South Korea, with China, and about seven other countries, as you know. And I chaired the Security Council. So I don't know about today's person that came forward. I do know about the lawyer. And you don't get much worse, bad reputation to take a look at his past. So as far as the other women are concerned, I'm going to see what happens tomorrow. I'm going to be watching. You know, believe it or not, I'm going to see
What's that? So it's possible that they will be convincing. Now, with all of that being said, Judge Brett Kavanaugh has been for many years one of the most respected people in Washington. He's been on, I guess you'd call it, the second highest court. And every single person knows him. A lot of people know him well. And those people don't believe what's going on. I can always be convinced. I have to hear it.
It sounds like what you're saying is there is a situation, there is a scenario under which you would withdraw Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. Is that correct?
If I thought he was guilty of something like this, yeah, sure.
And you will wait until tomorrow to make up your
mind? I want to watch. I want to see. I hope I can watch. I'm meeting with a lot of countries tomorrow, but I will certainly in some form be able to watch. And I'll also rely on some very fair and talented Republican senators who, look, if we brought George Washington here and we said, we have George Washington, the Democrats would vote against him, just so you understand. And he may have had a bad past. Who knows? You know, he may have had some, I think, accusations made. Didn't he have a couple of things in his past? George Washington would be voted against 100% by Schumer and the con artists. I mean, 100%, 100%. So it really doesn't matter from their standpoint. That's why when John asked about the FBI, if the FBI did the most thorough investigation in the history of the FBI and they found him to be 100% perfect, he would lose every single vote. Now, if the Republicans win tomorrow, I think you're going to get some votes from the Democrats. You know why? Because we all know why, because it's called politics. Then you'll probably get some votes. Okay, let's go. One more question. Yes.
Just to follow up.
She stands up. I'd like to ask about three questions. It's not really fair to everyone else, but should I let her ask another question? Go ahead.
To follow up on a question that a colleague asked as well about the benefit of the doubt that you have given to people like Roy Moore, to Roger Ailes, to Bill O'Reilly, to Brett Kavanaugh. They're all men. Why is that?
It's not a benefit of the doubt.
Has there ever been an instance when you've given the benefit of the doubt?
I've known them. Haley, I've known them for a long time. And a lot of these people. A lot of people. And some I've been disappointed with. I have been disappointed with some. Others, there are charges that are pretty weak. But I've known people for a long time. I never saw them do anything wrong. I never saw them do anything wrong. And there are some that probably I agree. I can tell you there are some that I've been watching for a long time. And in a couple of cases, they weren't Republicans. In a lot of cases, they were not. They were exactly the opposite. But I've been watching them for a long time. And I knew for a long time these were not good people. And they were never brought up. Okay. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead. Thank you very much, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. When the allegations first surfaced, you initially said how important it was for Dr. Ford to testify and that you wanted to hear from her.
I do.
But
I wish it could have gone quicker.
Well, you also said that if what she said were as bad as she claims, surely her or her parents would have reported it. And just today you said you would
have. Well, there is a truth. I mean, there is a chance that her parents could have reported it 36 years ago.
So my question is,
it doesn't mean they had to report it, because in some instances people keep it quiet. It's a very tough situation for a woman. There's no question about it. And in some cases they do report it. Frankly, had they reported it, it would have been pretty amazing, wouldn't it? But I guess they didn't, and that's okay. I'm not saying they had to report it, because it's a very personal thing. It's a very big problem. There's no question about it. Go ahead.
Do you want to hear her story before?
I'd like to hear her story, yeah. Well, we're giving her time.
Have you already made up your mind?
They would have given her time last week. This is the United States Senate. This is the most important position that a president can give out, I think we can say by far. I've actually heard it's the most important decision a president can make. I disagree with that. War and peace. I always say war and peace. And after that, Supreme Court justice, right? I look forward to hearing from her. We could have heard from her last week. We could have heard from her for a long time. It'll be interesting to hear what she has to say. Okay.
Let me follow up on Jim's question. Mr. President, let me follow up on Jim's question that I don't think we got an answer to.
Which one? Which question?
How have your personal experiences being accused by more than a dozen
women? I've been accused. False accusations.
Right.
Excuse me.
How have those?
I've been accused. And I was accused by, I believe it was four women. You can check with Sean Hannity. You can check with Fox, because they covered it very strongly. Who got paid? Excuse me. I was accused by four or five women who got paid a lot of money to make up stories about me. We caught them, and the mainstream media refused to put it on television. They refused to even write about it. There were four women, and maybe more. I think the number is four or five. But one had a mortgage paid off her house, $52,000. Another one had other things happen. And the one that reported it, I believe, was offered $750,000 to say bad things about me. And she is the one that reported it. This woman is incredible. She reported it instead of taking the money. So I've had numerous accusations about me.
Right.
They made false statements about me, knowing they were false. I never met them. I never met these people. And what did they do? What did they do? They took money in order to say bad things. I've had stories written in the New York Times front page about four women, the whole top center front page of the New York Times. I think it was four big pictures. I said, wow, that's a big thing. What's that? These were women that were quoted saying bad things about me. Not the worst things about me, but bad things. And I said, gee, that's too bad. I knew them a long time ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I said, that's too bad. I'm surprised at them. And then all of a sudden, I see them on television, nothing to do with me. The next day or day later, they were incensed. They said, Donald Trump is a nice guy. We never said this. The New York Times did false reporting. They're fake news. And you know what? The New York Times would not report that their story was fake. These women said great things. Not only did they not say the bad stuff, they said great things about me. Front page. And those women, they're incredible women. They went on television, and they didn't want to, and I didn't ask them. And they said the New York Times made it up. They gave false quotes. And they went on a lot of shows. They were really incensed, and they couldn't believe it. That's why people know that a lot of the news is fake, and a lot of the people sitting here are fake. But 20% of them are wonderful, okay?
If I could just actually ask question, Mr. Trump. You didn't let me ask my question.
You've been asking a question for 10 minutes. Please sit down. Please,
I'm
go ahead.
You,
go
ahead. How did those impact your opinions on the allegations against
Well, it does impact my opinion. You know why? Because I've had a lot of false charges made against me. I'm a very famous person, unfortunately. I've been a famous person for a long time. But I've had a lot of false charges made against me, really false charges. I know friends that have had false charges. People want fame. They want money. They want whatever. So when I see it, I view it differently than somebody sitting home watching television where they say, oh, Judge Kavanaugh, this or that. It's happened to me many times. I've had many false charges. I had a woman sitting in an airplane, and I attacked her while people were coming onto the plane, and I have a number one bestseller out. I mean, it was a total phony story. There are many of them. So when you say, does it affect me in terms of my thinking with respect to Judge Kavanaugh? Absolutely, because I've had it many times. And if the news would have reported these four people, I couldn't believe it. When I heard that they caught these four people, I said, wow, that's a big story. And it was for Fox.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.